Another JPN and Amittai Grand Round session. Before I begin, I want to give a special thank you to Rabbi Shlomo Brody from Amittai and to Chemed Health for making this Grand Rounds possible. It's an immense honor to introduce our distinguished speaker, Rabbi Dr. Jason Weiner, for today's session, in which we will be discussing the ethical framework for making decisions for unrepresented patients. Rabbi Weiner is the senior rabbi and executive director of the Spiritual Care Department at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. With a doctorate in clinical bioethics and his rabbinical ordination, Rabbi Weiner is uniquely positioned to explore tonight's topic. In addition to his academic background and distinguished career in healthcare leadership, Rabbi Weiner has authored dozens of book chapters and articles and is the author of several books on medical ethics, which I recommend to our viewers take a look at, especially The Jewish Guide to Practical Medical Decision-Making. Now, with that said, it's just a real pleasure to host tonight's session. Without further ado, Rabbi Jason Weiner.
All right, thank you. Well, it's likewise quite an honor to be with all of you. I frequently, very frequently, listen to the podcasts you put out or watch the YouTubes, and it's been really high quality, and I've learned a lot from it, and it's just such a wonderful organization. I'm really happy to be able to share some ideas with you and also hear your feedback and to learn from all of you. The issue that we're talking about this evening, I'll show you my PowerPoint. The issue is Jewish values in medical decision-making for unrepresented patients, a ritualized approach. This is an approach that I developed, I'll share with you, and that I think is one that's really, really important. What got me, we were just talking about this before, and what got me really thinking about this is the frequency with which this issue arises. You know, I mean, they say that now in the ICUs, about 5% of patients in America actually are unrepresented. Just to define our terms, first of all, an unrepresented patient is someone who does not have anyone to speak for them. Sometimes they're not just unrepresented, they're unidentified. We don't even know their name. We know nothing about them. Unrepresented would mean that we just don't know anything about this patient. We might know who they are, but we don't know anything about them, and there's no one to speak on their behalf. So as you can imagine, this comes up with all kinds of patients, but especially either people who lack capacity, whether it's because they're intubated, they're in some kind of coma or vegetative state, or that they just lack capacity due to severe advanced Alzheimer's, or senility, or Parkinson's, or severe mental illness. We find it in my experience, we find it most frequently in patients who are experiencing homelessness. In Los Angeles, we have a very high population of patients of people in general who are experiencing homelessness, and especially where my hospital, Cedars-Sinai, is located in the Hollywood area. There's just, you know, unfortunately, we have a lot of people who are really suffering and living on the streets, and they end up in the hospital on a regular basis. And of course, we care for them like anyone else, but oftentimes we have to make decisions for them. We have to figure out what's the right thing to do. And whereas with most patients, we would have some kind of a family meeting or ethics consult to help, you know, work with either their advance directive or their family, their surrogates, to figure out what's the right thing to do. When you have patients who do not have anyone to speak for them, we have to figure out the best way to honor them and care for them and treat them appropriately. And in our hospital, we have something called a special ethics review. We have a committee. It's made up of our bioethics committee, primarily staffed by actual employees of our Center for Healthcare Ethics, but they have in their policy to also have someone who's not an employee of their Center for Healthcare Ethics, but a member of the bioethics committee. And typically that's me. And we do this a few times a week. At least I'm called in for them a few times a week. I mean, it happens on a regular basis, sometimes a few times a day. And when I first started getting more involved with this, you know, about a decade ago, I personally, for myself, like as I do with most issues that arise in the hospital, I really wanted to know, what does halacha say about it? What does Jewish law say about it? Are there Jewish values that are relevant? And I did a lot of research. And, you know, as you mentioned, I've done a doctorate in clinical bioethics. And I think I know a little bit about how to research, but I could not find anything written on Jewish values or Jewish law as it relates to caring for unrepresented patients and making decisions for them. So I felt like, you know, this is a gap in the literature, and there's just not a lot being talked about it. Maybe because it wasn't always as common, it's becoming more common. You know, first of all, we couldn't do as much, you know, technologically as we can do today. And, you know, we have an aging population, and just as I mentioned with the crisis of unhoused people, it's an increasing dilemma. And so I decided, you know, let me look into it and see what I can come up with and really think about it a lot, just because I'm spending so much time actually dealing with it. So so I tried to come up with an approach that that both compares and contrasts secular bioethics, but also brings Jewish values to say something new about the topic. And we know that when it comes to Jewish values in decision making, the truth is not just Jewish values. In general, when we have patients for whom they cannot speak for themselves, we have a number of different standards. The gold standard, of course, is an advance directive, so that they can actually speak for themselves, so to speak. If we have some kind of advance directive whereby the values of the patient have been made known, that's the best. And I'll just give a plug for, you mentioned Amitai, for the Nativot advance directive that we recently produced with Amitai. You can look it up on the Amitai website, and it has both rabbinic approbation and has really been carefully tested in hospitals. It's based on the initial advance directive that we made at Cedars-Sinai for Jewish patients, and that's obviously the gold standard. If you can have an advance directive, you have some evidence of what the patient wants, that's ideal. If not, then in general, in bioethics and in Judaism, we say that, you know, there's two standards for decision making. One is known as substituted judgment, which is basically, what would they want? What would that patient say if they were here right now? We know that oftentimes, you know, families get it wrong. We know studies show that when families guess at what the patient would want, they get it wrong. But we know that actually physicians, when they guess on behalf of patients, they get it wrong more frequently, the data shows. But we try our best to act on behalf of the patient and do what they would say if they are available. That is, you know, ideal. But there's also something that is called the best interest standard. And the best interest standard is also seeking to promote the patient's welfare. And it basically says that, you know, we should do what's in the best interest of that patient. When we don't know what they want, we should just try to figure out what we think is the best thing. You know, what would most people say in this situation? What do we think is best? And that's also, you know, there's something to be said for that. And that actually ends up being prioritized, especially in pediatrics, where, you know, you can't really make substitute judgments, especially for very, very small children and babies, infants. The best interest standard oftentimes is what we follow. But both in bioethics and in Jewish law, the rabbis and bioethicists primarily usually say that substituted judgment, if there's no advance directive, that's the goal. The goal is, what would the patient say if they could speak for themselves right now? The rabbis often say the reason why we follow that is because usually the family, you know, has no authority per se, but they know the best. They know the patient the best. They could represent the patient's desires the best. If they don't know, I mean, I asked Rav Asher Weiss once, you know, what if the family just has no idea? He said, you know, we should just go by majority of the family. They should just do their best. But it's not that the family has any inherent authority. It's just that they might know the patient the best and have the patient's interests at heart. But, you know, there's challenges with that as well, because sometimes you have a family member there to make decisions for the patient, but the family member themselves have, you know, conflict of interest or don't have decision-making capabilities, you know, or adequate knowledge of the patient. And so you're back to square one without the ability to make a decision. And so how do we do it? So as I mentioned at the outset, underrepresented patients currently make up over 5% of deaths in ICUs. And the numbers are increasing. The truth is that data is from 2019, and we have data now post-pandemic that the numbers got worse in the pandemic. As you can imagine, in the heart of COVID, they were especially bad, just because you oftentimes had family members not even allowed to be in the hospital, and that just made decision-making more complicated. But we know that the numbers are increasing. So 5% of all deaths in American ICUs being of underrepresented patients, that's a lot. That's a big percentage, and that's a lot. You know, that's a lot of people. That's deaths every single day, And obviously we know that these are some of the most vulnerable individuals in our society. And because we don't know what they want, they're often exposed to over-treatment, under-treatment, delayed treatment, or just to receive medical care that conflicts with their own goals, values, preferences, best interests. And so this is a major dilemma. And especially if we care about promoting patients' welfare, we should be concerned about how to best make these decisions for people. Right now, there is no uniform decision-making standard or laws in the United States that can guide care providers in these cases. There's not a consensus on the proper procedures. There's a lot of articles that have been written that express different perspectives. The most common approach, though, is that an individual physician unilaterally makes all healthcare decisions with almost no oversight. Some hospitals, some places require, you know, a second physician to sign off. Sometimes they require an attending physician to make the decision if it's more complicated, whereas a resident can in more routine cases. But in general, most places it's sufficient for one physician to unilaterally make these decisions. And this is a challenge, as you can imagine, both given the fact that physicians often rotate, and each physician, each attending might have different views about the proper care, and unrepresented patients are therefore exposed to lack of continuity of care and a certain arbitrariness in decision making. And as you can imagine, that's why this becomes one of the most difficult challenges in hospitals and bioethics today. The lack of oversight and the lack of uniform decision-making standards really, you know, especially because of studies that show that physicians often make decisions based on their own preferences, not what the patient values. That's understandable. Most people are like that. We assume people want what we think they would want. But that's if we really want to respect diversity in different people, we should be respecting their own goals, values, and preferences. So now I want to That's the problem. That's the issue. That's the dilemma. Now what I want to share is, given all this dilemma and imagining these patients, and you know, maybe I'll even just share a couple of anecdotes that we might come back to, because then I want to share what I think, what Jewish values can inform very specific recommendations. I'm going to make three recommendations, two of which have been recommended in the bioethics literature, though I recommend a certain approach within that. And then my third one is going to be something unique that I'll suggest, and I would really love to hear your thoughts about that. There is, and we will discuss, and I see the question about, you know, can you make an inference from the halachos of Egla Rufa that the basic can make decisions for the unknown? That is certainly the case. And the truth is there are a lot of halachic issues, you know, like, for example, about a protropus for Yosomim, that, you know, decision makers can make decisions. The Gemara talks about for orphans. Also, the Gemara talks about a person, mishanishtata, a person that loses mental capacity. That the Gemara says, based in Yordin and Chasav, the Zanin Mefarnasin es Ishto. The based in actually has the right to take over a person's assets if they're not able to support their family. So there's a lot of halachic discussion about that, but not as much when it comes to unrepresented patients. And that's why the approach that I'm going to take is based on primarily Jewish values, not so much Jewish law, as we'll discuss, even though I'm going to suggest practical suggestions. So let's imagine a few cases. Unrepresented patients can be a very wide variety. As I mentioned, we often have patients who are unhoused who, you know, unfortunately they overdose, or they're hit by a car, or there's some kind of altercation, they end up in the hospital, we know nothing about them. That's, I think, the most common that we experience. But we have a lot of variations. I remember a case, I'm just changing very slight variables to protect anonymity, but I remember a case of an adult who came to the ICU, but a younger adult, who we really, really searched for some family, and at first we couldn't find any family, so we thought, okay, we'll have to have a special ethics review. We'll have to make a decision for them. We don't know anything about them. We knew their name. They were not unidentified. They were unrepresented. But after a lot of search, we actually found their parents, and we were excited. Okay, we don't have to decide for them now. The parents will decide. We called the parents, and the parents said, it's intentional that you couldn't find us. We want nothing to do with them. We don't want anything to do with you, and you make whatever decisions you want. Please don't call us again. So that's an extreme example, very sad, but that patient was considered unrepresented because even though we found the family was estranged from the patient. And so even when we tried to ask them, can you tell us anything about the patient? They said, no, we don't want anything to do with them. And they hung up on us, actually. We could infer some things, though, and that's going to be something we'll discuss later. Once you know something about them, can you use that to infer anything? For example, we found a patient once who, the first responders found a patient, individual who was living on the streets. On one of the streets in Los Angeles that's known as a Jewish street, right in front of a synagogue, and he had a big beard. The question became, now, all we know about him is he's experiencing homelessness. He has a beard. That's not so uncommon for men who are living on the streets. But he was also in a Jewish neighborhood in front of a synagogue. Should we impose Jewish law on the decision-making for this individual? That became a dilemma. Or how far can you go with making inferences? For example, I remember a time we had to make a decision for a patient, which was, we would have had to put him through very invasive medical procedures to keep him alive and prolong his life. And we had to decide for him, would he want that? This is something that many people would choose to undergo, many interventions and a lot of pain and suffering in order to stay alive, and some people would not. The only thing we knew about him was that he had amputated legs. And the question became, can we infer from the fact that he has had his legs amputated that he is willing to therefore go through medical interventions to prolong his life? It seems like he at one point made a decision to have his legs amputated. So did that mean that he did that in order to prolong his life, and he's therefore willing? Meaning, how far can we go? Or what if we find someone, which this happens actually more commonly, we find someone, we can't find any family members, but we can find some kind of a shelter or some place where they frequented. And we can find, let's say, a pastor of a church or something who says, oh, yeah, this man, he used to come to our church services, or, or we have some roommate who lived in a facility with them, and they know that they used to pray a lot or something like that. Can we use that to infer, religious values? All these are just examples. We'll discuss more soon. But now what I want to do is share with you the Jewish values that I believe are most relevant, and the suggestions that I think that they imply. And I do this based on a Sifri. It's also a Yerushalmi in Kachim, which quotes Rabbi Akiva and Ben Azai as discussing what are the most important Jewish values. What is the key fundamental Jewish values? And they debate it. And Rabbi Akiva argues that ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself, ze kol gadol b'Torah, that is the most important thing of all. We have to, follow, love your neighbor as yourself. That's our primary motivating value. Whereas Ben Azai said, no, it's a different value. Ze sefer toldos ha'adam, the verse in Genesis and Bereishis, which says this is the book of the generations of Adam, that's an even more all-encompassing principle, because the verse ends with the idea that, Tzelem Elokim, all people are created in the image of God. So I want to look at both these values and argue that actually these two values can provide us with a very direct approach. Love your neighbor as yourself. The truth is, it's very common in medical ethics, both secular and Jewish, by the way. If you look at Bauchamp and Childress' Principles of Biomedical Ethics, the four principles approach, they argue that the principle of beneficence is based on, they actually say, it's a secular approach, but they say it's rooted in biblical values of love your neighbor as yourself. And when you look in halacha, you'll find that the requirement to attempt to heal the sick, to practice medicine itself, or Bikercholim, visiting the sick, Nichum Aveilim, comforting mourners, Halavayas Ameis, escorting the dead. Actually, you find Sefer Chassidim writes, avoiding infecting others. This came up a lot during the pandemic, right? The obligation to avoid endangering others is actually based on love your neighbor as yourself. The rabbis actually argue that palliative care, hospice, advanced pain medications, they argued the source of the obligation to provide palliative care is based on love your neighbor as yourself. Who would want to suffer? Prohibition against desecrating a corpse, nivul hames, That is based on Ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. But there is, a fascinating debate when it comes to love your neighbor as yourself. You might have heard of this. We actually discussed this a lot in the hospital when we train new employees. That's the difference between the golden rule and the platinum rule. Right? You know, is love your neighbor as yourself, does it just mean treat others the way you would want to be treated? Because if so, I just mentioned a minute ago that studies show that when physicians make decisions for patients, studies show that they often make those decisions based on their own goals and values and preferences, not on the patient's. But the obligation to care for people is to treat them based on their goals, values, their preferences. We should be treating people the way they want to be treated, not the way we want to be treated. And the truth is, there is a lot of bioethics literature. And by the way, I'll just mention, I'm not trying to do any kind of self-promotion, but everything I'm saying now, I recently published a book called Care and Covenant with Georgetown University Press, A Jewish Bioethic of Responsibility. This is a chapter in that book, and everything I'm saying is noted in the footnotes. So if you want to look up any of this, it's all noted there. Anyways, there's a lot of literature in the bioethics literature critiquing the golden rule. We often are very proud. Look at this, is Jewish. So many religions and people quote the golden rule, but it comes from us. It comes from Judaism. But there's actual literature in the bioethics literature critiquing the golden rule and saying, like, you know, is that really sufficient to just treat people the way you would want to be treated? Maybe you should be treating people the way they would want to be treated. Of course, the platinum rule has its own problems, meaning a drug addict, let's say, does that mean because they have a problem with addiction, but that's what they want, so that's what I should provide? Like, how far do we go with that? So what's fascinating is that actually I believe that the true understanding of the golden rule actually is the platinum rule, within reason, obviously, what's actually helpful for people. But I'll show you two sources that I base that on when I say that the golden rule, when we say v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, the golden rule, it is what they mean by the platinum rule, and therefore the critique, I think, is somewhat misplaced. Based on a couple of commentaries. Number one, the Sforno. The Sforno's great commentary. He says, when it says ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, he writes, ahov b'yad reacha, love the other, show love towards other, masha haisa ohev b'adcha im haisa magia l'makomo. Love others the way you would want to be loved if you were in their shoes. And he's talking here about kind of emotionally feel their pain as though it was your pain. Like, you should feel for others. You should try to put yourself in their place. Loving others means trying to feel their pain, not your pain. The Bechor Shor goes even further. These are both, Bechor Shor is a Rishon. Bechor Shor writes that, why does it say v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha? Right? Not like v'ahavta et reacha kamocha. What's the le reyecha? So he says, k'mosha ata rotze she'ahev otcha, the way you want others to love you, de'alcha sani l'chavercha lo tavid, like what is hateful to you, don't do to others, she'eno omer she'ahev acher k'mo atzmo, it's not saying I should love people the way I want, right? If I love, chocolate, I should give everyone chocolate. No, the point is that would be ve'ahavta, et reyecha kamocha. Shim haya rotze lomar she'ahev acher kamo atzmo haya lo lichtov ve'ahavta et reyecha kamocha. Or it would have said ve'ahavta lo kamocha. No, but it says ve'ahavta et reyecha kamocha. I'm sorry, but since it says ve'ahavta le reyecha kamocha, it means act lovingly and focus on the actions towards others, the same actions that you would want, the actions that they want, what's considered love to them, not what you would feel loved by. Okay, don't worry. We're getting back to the point. But this actually leads to an important ethic also in Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avot says in the very end of Pirkei Avos, but it talks about one of the very important a number of important values, and one of them it says is to be nosei be'ol im chavero. Nosei be'ol im chavero, strive to feel other people's pain. Right, to actually try to feel their pain. And as many of the Bali Musar, the ethical writers, write on that Mishnah, that it means trying to feel what it's like to be that person, trying to understand, who they are. Oftentimes in chaplaincy, we often say that, our key three words, and this is in medicine as well, the most important three words in chaplaincy are, tell me more. Tell me more. Help me understand you, what you're going through. I want to understand you. I'm not trying to decide for you. I want to know what matters to you. That's what it's all about. So that's one. Love your neighbor as yourself, but love, show love to them the way they want to be treated. Okay. Don't worry. We're getting to the point. So that's value number one. Value number two of these values that are mentioned, is now Ben Azai, argued that, you know, the most important value is Tzelem Elokim, that we're created in the image of God. And the truth is, it seems to be that Ben Azai is disagreeing with Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva said it's love your neighbor as yourself. Ben Azai says, no, it's everyone's in the image of God. But actually some argue that he's agreeing with Rabbi Akiva, but he's giving the reason. Why should you love others? Because everyone's created in the image of God. This is a key fundamental Jewish principle that, to be honest, I don't know that we talk about it enough, even though we do talk about it, but it's the core of Judaism, is recognizing the image of God in every human being. And this also, much of Jewish law as it relates to the practice of medicine is also based in this concept of Tzelem Elokim, every human being in the image of God. For example, the prohibition against murder is based on respecting Tzelem Elokim. The obligation to bury the dead is based on Tzelem Elokim. The duty to save life, because everyone's in the Tzelem Elokim. And this actually leads to a value that is known as Kavod Habrios. Kavod Habrios, which actually overrides many principles in the Torah, is a key value of respecting the inherent dignity in every person. In fact, this is what I have here. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik writes that the Torah says in Genesis, in the image of God, he created man. This metaphysical idea leads to the halachic principle of Kavod Habrios, the dignity of humanity. Meaning, it's not just a value. Not that that's, I mean, just being a value is sufficient, but it's saying it's a value and it is also a matter of Jewish law. It's actually halacha that we should treat people with dignity. But it goes further. It goes into specific actions. So now I want to show you a specific action that's based on this, and you're going to start to see how we are coming to my recommendations and how this gets us right back to the whole issue of care for unrepresented or unidentified patients. And I do this based on maybe a counterintuitive source, but I think it's actually extremely relevant. Jewish law permits capital punishment. The Torah permits capital punishment. We know that the rabbis severely limited capital punishment. They severely limited to the point of almost never allowing capital punishment to actually occur in practice. One of the ways they did, there's a number of ways that the rabbis limited the enforcement of capital punishment. And one of those ways is the Mishnah here in Sanhedrin, Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph. The Mishnah talks about how the rabbis would examine the witnesses in capital cases. And the way they had to examine the witnesses, it says, Ketzad Maimin et Ta'idim. How did we basically intimidate the witnesses, because we wanted to remind them of the dignity of every person. We want to remind the witnesses, you know, you have someone's, the defendant's life in your hands. And we have to take that very, very, very seriously. So they were told, they were primed, basically, that you have to remember something about every person, even the person that's being that's on trial for murder right now, that you're considering convicting of a capital offense. You have to be reminded of things about them. Three things. Three very, very important things that this Mishnah states. Number one, it says, Nivra ha'adam yechidi. Every person was created alone. In other words, we come from Adam. L'lamedcha, to teach you, shekol ha'mavid nefesh achas Yisrael, to teach you that anyone who causes someone to die, ma'ala l'avakasuv ki'ilu ibed olam malitz. Therefore, it's like you killed the whole world. V'chol ha'makayim nefesh achas Yisrael. Anyone who saves one life, you've heard this quote many times, ma'ala l'avakasuv ki'ilu kiyem olam malay. Each person is an entire world. We were created alone. We were created in the image of God. We were created as Adam to remind you that just like Adam was the entire world at one time, so too every human being is an entire world and their life is like its entire world. Okay? That's the one thing you would tell the witnesses. Number two, also very important, umipnei shalom habrios. There's a concept of shalom habrios, that the fact of being created in the image of God leads to peace amongst people. How? Shlo yomar adam l'chaveiro. So a person won't say to someone else, Abba gadol miavicha. My father is greater than your father. I'm from a better yichus. I'm come from a better family. V'shelo yihu haminim omrim, or that heretics won't say, harbe reshuyus b'shamayim. Oh, there's many, many gods. No, the idea is we all come from one God. We all come from the same genealogy, so to speak, and therefore there's a certain equality to each person, and you shouldn't look down. You might say, oh, that person who's convicted of murder is from a lower social strata than me. I don't really think of them as being very worthy, but you have to be reminded that we all come from one heavenly parent, and there is a certain equality based on that. And finally, Ulahagid Gedulaso Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The third point there, you have it's you're reminded of the fact that we're all created from Adam. We all come from Adam and Eve to teach you the greatness of God. Why? She Adam Tovea Kama Matbeos. A person can make many coins, especially in those days. A person can try to mint many coins. Bechosem Echad, even with one stamp. Kulam Domin Zeleze. And they are all identical. You mint stamps, you mint coins, and they're identical. Umelch Machim Malachim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but God, Tava Kol Adam Bechosmo Shel Adam Rishon, God created us all in God's image and with the stamp of Adam. Ve'ein echad mehem dom lechaver, and everyone is unique. Lefikach, therefore, kol echad ve'echad chayav lomar bishvili nivra olam. Therefore, everyone has to say, for me, the world was created. Now, those three statements that you make to the witnesses, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks and others argue that leads to three principles. Three principles. Number one, that every human is life is of immeasurable value. I put there, by the way, immeasurable value, even though Rabbi Sacks and others put infinite value, because to be honest, I don't think it's correct to say humans are of infinite value. Infinite value would mean there's nothing ever more valuable than human life. And I think human life is of relative value, relative to pain and suffering. We do sometimes let patients die when they are horribly suffering. We do spend resources on other things other than healthcare. Like there are other things in addition to the value of human life. So I don't say infinite value, but I would say human life is of immeasurable value. Number two, that all human life, every human life is of equal value. Every human life is of equal value. And number three, that everyone is unique. Every single person is unique. And therefore, we have to assume that every person, no matter how they might be belittled by society and how, you know, horrible they might look and how horrible the situation is and how they have no resources and no family and no one to speak on their behalf, every person has value. And we should try to respect that value, and not just that we should try, but actually we see now that it is a chiyuv deoraisa. It's a Torah obligation to care for them. And so based on that, we can start talking, and I'm going to show you one more source in a minute, but I'm going to save that. We can start to look at some of these values, how we can apply them to the issue of decision-making for unrepresented patients. So I'm going to share with you my first recommendation. This recommendation is stated by some bioethicists, meaning some bioethicists say it's enough to just have one physician make unilateral decisions and that's sufficient, or maybe sometimes have a second physician to sign off, which unfortunately oftentimes becomes, you know, a rubber stamp. But like some bioethicists, I argue that there should be a diligent attempt to find a surrogate or expand the list of who can be considered a valid surrogate in order to increase chances of finding someone who knows something about the patient's goals, values, and preferences. Meaning, we have to look for someone. Sometimes we say, well, we don't have any family here, so I guess we can't, this patient's unrepresented, that's it. But we often try, especially with our social workers, what can we find someone? What if this person has, you know, had a roommate or a pastor or a rabbi or someone who knows something that's valuable? Or there's evidence, like the case I told you. Maybe we can find some evidence. But I believe that we should be doing everything we can to try to find things out about people, because that's based on the very image of God of people and the concept of love your neighbor as yourself, love them as they would want to be treated. So therefore, we should be trying our best to learn about every single individual. But moreover, and for this actually, I'm going to show you one other source. Moreover, I think we can go even further if we stick with the laws of the Jewish law as it relates to capital punishment. There's another very, I think probably very counterintuitive ruling. But again, the rabbis were trying to limit capital punishment, the enforcement of it. But there's another ruling that I'll show you. This is really fascinating. This is, I'm just have the Rambam here for you in Hilchos Sanhedrin, Perek Tes. He summarizes it. But this is from the Talmud. They said as follows. You know, you had to have a court of 23 judges for a capital offense. So the rabbi said, Sanhedrin, shepaschu kulam bedine nefashos tchila v'amru kulan chayav. If there was a case, when all the judges in the Sanhedrin began their judgment of a case involving capital punishment, they all say that the defendant is liable. He's guilty. They need to be put to death. You would think, okay, that must mean that it's very obvious. Like, no. The rabbi said, Hare ze patur achiyu sham miksas mezakin shehofchu bezchuso v'yarbu hamechayvim v'achar kach yarog. They said, no. They're going to be exonerated if everyone agrees. There has to be at least someone who seeks to exonerate the defendant on the Beis Din, on the Sanhedrin, and argue of this, I'm sorry, in the Beis Din, and argue on his behalf. Yet the majority, even if the majority hold him liable, the majority hold liable, therefore they can be executed. But there has to be some disagreeing. And the Aruch HaShulchan and others write that the reason why you have to have some disagreeing is because there has to be some kind of an attempt to explain and understand the different perspectives. There has to be some attempt at trying to understand all perspectives. You can't just have a case where it's so simplistic that it's like, oh, it's so obvious what to do. We have to try to discuss and debate and have diverse views. And that's why I think we should also have the most rigorous safeguards of expertise, neutrality, and careful deliberation by following the more demanding process of involving a diverse interdisciplinary committee, meaning not just having one doctor decide unilaterally. And that committee should comprise individuals representing that patient's own religious or cultural community whenever possible or necessary, because they might, if they have their own specific, you know, communal identity, you know, especially if it's a case that's very routine or emergent, obviously decisions have to be made quicker. And in general, I understand those thinkers who say, you know, just let one doctor decide because they want the decision-making process to be easily accessible, quick, convenient, cost-effective. But I think that just gives the hospital an obligation to be able to form a committee very quickly. But having an interdisciplinary committee, I think, fulfills the value of that Rambam, the Gemara, that you should have difference of opinion in capital cases. After all, this is a capital case. We're often deciding patients' life and death in our decision-making process, right? Their life and death is in our hands and our decisions. And so if we're going to take that seriously, that this is their life and their death in our hands, we have to have a diverse committee of multiple people who can really debate it. And our role should be not to rubber stamp. When we're on those committees, we should be asking challenging questions. Oftentimes I'll say, you know, I'm sitting in this committee, I'm hearing everyone out, I agree with you, but let's just play devil's advocate for a minute. Let me just throw out a crazy idea. And a few times we've done that, I've had the experience where someone just threw out an idea and said, you know, let me just ask a crazy question. And the next thing we know, we're realizing, you know what, that's not so crazy. You bring up a good point, and we need to really think about this harder. And I think that's essential, and that we see based directly on that value of the need for all 23 judges not to be unanimous in their decision. But I want to go one step further based on what we've seen. Whoops. And offer one more recommendation, but this is one that is not, I did not see this in any literature anywhere else, but I think that this is a unique approach that arises directly from Jewish values that we've seen of, you know, love your neighbor as yourself, and the idea that every human being is of immeasurable value and of equal value, and that everyone is unique. And that is a ritualized approach that creates a statement. We know that priming statements are used in hospitals all the time, and not just hospitals, but they increase the likelihood of compliance with one's own values. So, for example, there's a lot of data, for example, on hand hygiene statements in hospitals. If you have little reminders of the importance of hand hygiene or vaccination in vaccine season, things like that, it increases compliance because it just kind of reminds people of their values. Priming statements are a classic and important aspect of healthcare, and they are they are exactly what the rabbis were saying should be done to witnesses before making the decision in a capital case. They were saying prime the witness first, but prime them in a positive way, meaning not priming them in ways that we sometimes look at negatively, but prime them to respect the dignity of the defendant before making a decision. Not priming them on what to say, but prime them to remind them of each human being's dignity. So I argue that that idea of priming, which we have throughout, you know, we have this in the morning, in the many, many Sidurim prayer books, start at the very beginning, say, you know, Harini Mekabel Alatzmi, I hereby take upon myself the mitzvah saseh shel v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, to love my neighbor as myself. And that's the very first thing many people say in the morning. We know that the Pesach Seder, that, you know, there's so many things in that the Sefer HaChinuch says. That's an example of acharei hapu'ulos nimshachin halavavos. Sometimes our actions lead to our feelings, our values, and there's this basic need to prime ourselves before decision making. So based on that, my suggestion is that there should be, before making decisions, before sitting down to deliberate about an individual case, there should be first a brief formal statement, ideally along with the picture of the patient, and to recognize who they are and their name if we have it. That's said in an inclusive manner and reminds healthcare practitioners of their duties and then of the value, equality, and uniqueness of every human being, modeled after the Talmudic statement made to witnesses in capital cases in order to protect these very vulnerable populations. And here's my example. I just made this up, so it's not like this is not like the same status of the Talmudic statements we read, but here's my example of a statement that we read before we start decision making in these committees. And one person simply reads and says, before engaging in making decisions on behalf of this patient, insert name as known, we hereby recognize their inherent value and uniqueness and commit ourselves to striving to understand who they are, fulfill our duties toward them, and caring for them equitably and with dignity to the best of our ability. Simply saying that line before engaging in caring for the patient. I purposely, by the way, when I wrote this, did not include the name of God in that. Obviously, for myself, I would want to say that they're created in the image of God. But working in a healthcare environment that's a diverse space, we want to respect everyone's, you know, diversity. I don't want to force people to read statements about the image of God if they don't believe in God. And I don't want them to think like, oh, this is religious. Well, I'm not religious, so I don't need to do this. This is not about religion. This is about respecting basic human dignity. And so that's why I suggest that there should be some kind of this statement, and that this statement can really prime committees to provide true care for patients. The truth is, in bioethics, many early bioethicists argued that like the whole concept of a bioethics committee was modeled after the ancient paradigm of the Greek chorus, where, you know, people would share different perspectives, and they argued that that would help them take it more seriously. But the truth is that in bioethics, it's really based on autonomy. It's based on the value of each individual's autonomy. And that's why, that's their goal. The Jewish approach, as you can see, is focusing on care providers' obligations to care for the patients and to protect their intrinsic dignity rather than just the patient's rights. It's as opposed to the autonomy, which of course autonomy is a beautiful thing, but the Jewish approach is more focusing on our obligations and it's an anchor to protect human dignity. And the idea is that ritualizing it ensures that these values will then be acted upon, and really that we take it seriously. It's not just an empty statement, but it's really putting it at the forefront of our minds. And this focus leads to this additional suggestion of a ritualized statement said at every meeting. And so therefore, my argument is that, you know, first of all, we should be taking, you know, these decisions for unrepresented patients very seriously, and we should be trying everything we can to find out something about their values. We have to take that seriously, that they have values. And yes, we have taken into account the fact that, you know, someone had amputations in the past, that might show us that, you know, they try to prolong their life, and, you know, whatever we can, or someone attended synagogue, being found on the street in front wasn't enough, but we got permission from case management to show a picture to the rabbi of that synagogue where they were found, and we found that indeed the patient did frequent that synagogue, and therefore we should take into account Jewish values when caring for that patient, because that's at least something we know about them. So the obligation to love others the way they want to be loved encourages us to try hard to find a surrogate. The obligation to recognize the dignity of every person and therefore be concerned about their lives and see the Tzelem Elokim, the image of God in everyone, and not just so willy-nilly be willing to end their lives, and that there has to be some disagreement, encourages that we can't just allow one person to unilaterally make this decision. We really need to have diverse interdisciplinary committees making these decisions. And finally, I argue that we should ritualize it with a priming ritual that helps us to really inculcate these values and make sure that they are acted upon in every case. So this is my suggestion. This is something that we do try our best to carry out in our hospital. And it's, as I said, we have a lot of experience with it. And I take it really as a sacred duty when we have patients who are really, really vulnerable. And, you know, wouldn't we all, we all hope we have families and loved ones who will care for us. But I hope we would all want to know that if we were ever in a situation where we were so vulnerable that we had people caring for us who didn't even know our names, that they would take that obligation and that responsibility seriously and care for us with real compassion and concern for our dignity and our own values, especially, you know, if we have Jewish values inherent in our decision-making, I hope that they would make an effort to find that out and therefore incorporate Jewish values into decision-making for us. So I'd really love to hear your reaction and your thoughts about that. And any comments or questions? And I do see that, I see the comments about, you know, it's universal for all humans, not just for Jews. Indeed, that's how I wrote it. The Mishnah writes there, Israel of every Jew, but the version of it in the Yerushalmi and other texts leave out the word Israel and indeed argue that the Tzelem Elokim is found in every single human being. Every human being is created in the image of God.
Thank you so much. Really incredible talk, and like you said, kind of groundbreaking. There's not much. It definitely was a gap in the literature. We'll take questions if anyone has. You're more than welcome to put in the chat. Links in the chat as well. One is a link to Rabbi Weiner's latest book, Care and Covenant, on Amazon. Additionally, if you found this interesting, we work together with Amitai, who hosts a number of these sessions, and our organization is Jewish Physicians Network. If there are any medical trainees or physicians on here that are interested in that, you can look us up on that link as well.
Oh, great.
I was one of the founding fathers of the Haifat. To what degree do you carry that?
Right. No, that's so a great point.
Still stuck with that problem. Clearly, you have to try to find as much as about the patient as you can. And also, you didn't mention any. That's one question. Someone to a guardian.
Yeah.
That was putting his patient in guardianship.
Yeah.
It's own problems because it takes forever in New Jersey.
Yes.
Forever to get that done.
Yes.
And there are always decisions to make that need to be made before that.
Agreed. That's why we try to avoid going to the courts. It really slows things down, and I don't think that the courts necessarily make the best decisions on behalf of patients. And regarding your first point, yeah, it's a very important point, and I agree with you. The issue is, you know, when we say, how do you decide? Who decides? And, you know, respecting people's autonomy, when we're talking about people who we just know nothing about them, so that's why we have to follow back, and that's when we do follow back on the best interest standard. I mean, our ideal is substituted judgment, trying to do what they would say they want. But if we do not know anything about what they would want, so we do rely on best interest standard. We have to say, well, what's in this person's best interest? We have to take that responsibility very seriously and say, you know, let's really think, if we were the person's family, or the family was here, in our experience caring for patients, what are the types of things that most people would bring up? What are the types of things that people would be concerned about? How can we defend this person's basic human dignity with when we don't know what they want. So yeah, we have to go, we have to just try to figure out their best interest. We try our best to learn something about them. And if we can't, we say, okay, well, what's in their best interest? What, and oftentimes that ends up being a majority, you know, when you have a committee and you kind of try to figure out what do most people think is the right thing, having taken seriously our obligations towards this individual whom we don't know. Because it's important to point out that it's not just about coming to an agreement, but about who's agreeing and the quality of the deliberative process to make good deliberations, to really make careful, well-reasoned decisions where we take seriously our obligations to make these decisions with real COVID roche.